Support for Newsworthy comes from Enlivion, providing affordable housing and supportive services to help build strong foundations for a better future for hardworking families, seniors, and the disabled in Charlotte. More information available at enlivion.com. And from Thrivent, a financial services company working with individuals and families to develop strategies for managing their money and planning for the future. More information at mark.hargrove@thrivent.com.
From 90.7 WFAE, this is Newsworthy for Thursday, May 8th, 2025. I'm Eric Thiel. In a closed session on Monday, Charlotte City Council agreed to a settlement with Police Chief Johnny Jennings after he received threatening texts from former City Council member Tariq Bakari. According to our Steve Harrison, the settlement is for more than $100,000. Mayor Vi Lyles joined Charlotte Talks Wednesday morning and said she wouldn't talk about the settlement.
Human resource items in closed session are not appropriate for me to talk about. I think we've had this conversation once before, and it's just one of those things, and I can't remember who followed up on it, but honestly, there is no way for a council member to talk about what happens in a closed session meeting.
Mayor Lyles and city council members held an extraordinary news conference Wednesday afternoon to respond to comments made by city council member Victoria Watlington, who said the city's actions to reach a financial settlement with Police Chief Jennings were unethical, immoral, and, quote, frankly illegal. Steve Harrison has more.
On Monday night, Watlington sent an email to constituents blasting the city's decision to pay Jennings. She wrote, quote, "I have witnessed the brazen disregard for dissenting opinions in the rule of law." Watlington was upset over how city officials handled negotiations in closed session over the last 2 weeks. In one instance, a council member who left the meeting early was counted as a yes vote. In another, a council member wasn't allowed to change their vote, a move that could have derailed the settlement. With other council members behind her, Lyles said,
"I could not let it go with the allegations made by Councilmember Watlington against this organization. They are serious, and they damage the reputation of this organization. To be clear, these allegations are unfounded, and if she has any proof, she needs to provide that to the city attorney's office, who is duty-bound to investigate."
The financial settlement stems from threatening text messages sent by former Councilmember Tariq Bakari to Jennings during a dispute over whether officers should be allowed to wear new protective vests. Bakari said he would work to have Jennings fired and said he would cripple his reputation. Councilmember Malcolm Graham called for the city to launch an internal investigation into which council members were speaking to the media about closed session discussions. Interim City Attorney Anthony Fox said any discussion of a closed session is a criminal offense, but that assertion is not supported by state law. Steve Harrison, WFAE News.
Last month, Republican Representative Tricia Cotham filed a bill to the state house that would allow Mecklenburg County residents to vote on a 1 cent sales tax increase. The tax would fund roads and transit projects in the county. Mayor Lyles on Wednesday said potential voters should look at the bill from a different perspective, as a growth stimulant.
I think that the adage is that if you're not growing, you're what? Dying? Or you're not going to be the place that we want to be. And we want to have a great city. We want to have a city that people choose, not people that they just go to Myrtle Beach after they get through.
The candidate filing deadline for this year's Charlotte municipal elections is in July. Mayor Lyles began her third term in 2022, and many wonder, will her name be on the ballot in November? In her appearance on Charlotte Talks Wednesday, Mayor Lyles didn't directly say whether she's running again.
You know, as long as this community believes that I have something to contribute, then I will always try to do my very best to serve.
6 months after the November election, Republican Jefferson Griffin has conceded the race for a seat on the North Carolina Supreme Court. Incumbent Democrat Allison Riggs won the election by over 700 votes, and this week a federal judge ordered the State Board of Elections to certify the results with Riggs as the winner. In a statement reported by several media outlets, Griffin says he does not plan to appeal that latest ruling. North Carolina's new elections board was sworn in this week. In their first meeting, the board, which now has a 3-2 Republican majority,
selected Republican Francis DeLuca as their new chair. They also dismissed the state's executive director, Karen Brinson Bell, who was appointed by former Democratic Governor Roy Cooper in 2019, declining to renew her appointment for another two-year term. They voted to hire Republican attorney Samuel Hayes instead. Board member Siobhan Millen, a Democrat, blasted the vote.
I think this is a shabby way to treat a nationally admired executive election director, and further, that the recent habit of changing the executive director whenever the composition of the election board changes runs counter to our goal to bolster people's faith in fair elections.
Brinson Bell tried to make a statement after the vote, but the board adjourned without letting her speak. North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis says he won't support Ed Martin's nomination by President Trump as U.S. Attorney for Washington, D.C. Tillis said he met with Martin, but has no tolerance for people who entered the Capitol on January 6th. Martin has purged non-political career staff involved in the investigations of the January 6th attack. Tillis spoke with reporters on Wednesday.
If Mr. Martin were being put forth as a U.S. attorney for any district except the district where January 6th happened, the protest happened, I'd probably support him, but not in this district.
That could sink Martin's nomination before the Senate Judiciary, of which Tillis is a member. His no vote would leave the committee deadlocked at 11-11, with all 10 Democrats on the panel opposing Mr. Martin. The North Carolina House passed a bill Wednesday to direct state agencies to vet residents' immigration status before providing them benefits. The bill includes the Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Commerce, and the University of North Carolina system. Here's Representative Deb Butler of New Hanover County.
This is going to be cataclysmic for our agencies. It's going to force them, who are already stretched thin, to become immigration enforcement officers.
Some state agencies already ensure that people are lawful North Carolina residents before providing them benefits. The bill now heads to the North Carolina Senate for consideration. Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools presented its 2025-26 budget to Mecklenburg County on Wednesday, asking the Board of Commissioners to approve $667 million in funding to pay for staff raises and Chromebooks for students. Amid some tough questioning, a common thread emerged: concern over state funding for education. James Farrell has more.
Commissioners expressed concern about teacher pay. The CMS budget proposal asks the county for a 5% raise in the local teacher salary supplement. But Superintendent Crystal Hill said that the conversation needs to be happening at the state level, which sets base teacher salaries. She pointed to the fact that the state offers an additional supplement that's available to nearly all counties except four, including Mecklenburg County.
Start thinking about what we are already doing as residents of North Carolina, and that is paying state taxes that should be paying the base salary for every single teacher in North Carolina, including those, the 9,000 that work right here in Charlotte Mecklenburg schools.
Hill said the district was trying to keep Mecklenburg County's own tight budget in mind. She suggested joint action, like a resolution, to lobby the state. County Commissioner Vilma Leek similarly called for a joint day of lobbying in Raleigh with educators in the community. James Farrell, WFAE News.
Charlotte Ballet has lost a federal grant for a dance scholarship program. The dance company learned of the rescission on Friday. It says the grant from the National Endowment for the Arts was meant to provide scholarships to low-income dance students in Charlotte. Dozens of U.S. arts organizations have reported losing NEA grants in recent days, including Charlotte-based Three Bone Theater, which has lost the remainder of a $20,000 grant meant to help stage three plays centered around immigrant characters. Some child care providers plan to close next week as part of an annual initiative that aims to raise awareness of problems with funding and staffing such centers. Elvis Meneyese has more.
Pathway Preschool in East Charlotte plans to close on Monday for the National Day Without Childcare Initiative. The center serves 62 children. Their campaign focuses on affordable childcare rates for families, better wages for providers, and more teachers. Emma Biggs is the director of Pathway Preschool. She says additional funds would help deal with several problems.
We can pay our staff what they're worth. we would not have a problem with quality child care. We wouldn't have a problem with having a child care desert. You know, we would be able to open up our classrooms because people would be coming back to the field. Instead, now people are leaving the field because they can go somewhere else and make more money with less headache.
Federal funds from the American Rescue Plan enabled childcare programs during the COVID-19 pandemic in North Carolina to increase wages, retain staff, and offer other benefits. But those funds came to an end last year, as well as extended grants approved by legislators that ran out in March. Big says seven other centers in Charlotte plan to close for a day next week. Elvis Meneyese, WFA News.
As we reported Wednesday, one of Charlotte's best-known homegrown companies is being sold. Avid Exchange was formed in 2000, and as of the end of last year, had over 1,600 employees. For more on the sale and other business stories of the week, Tony Messia of the Charlotte Ledger Business Newsletter spoke to our Marshall Terry for our segment, Bizworthy.
Avid Exchange is a name many people in Charlotte, I'm sure, recognize, but how did they become one of Charlotte's rare unicorns or a billion-dollar startup?
Yes, Marshall, it is a recognizable name. You've probably seen it, for example, on the Avid Exchange Music Factory, which is near Avid Exchange's headquarters near Uptown. It's a financial technology company that automates invoices for medium-sized businesses. This is a tech company that started in 2000, basically with two guys meeting at Anderson's restaurant in Elizabeth. It was an old-time restaurant where power brokers used to exchange ideas, no longer around. But they just built it up over the years, took it public, and now it's being sold to a couple of private companies.
So what are the plans?
This week, two companies, TPG, which is a private equity company, and Corpay, which is a payments company, announced that they were buying AvidXchange in a deal that values the company at $2.2 billion. By taking a company private, you have a little bit more flexibility. Maybe you have a little bit more money to invest and grow. And I think the idea would be to incorporate AvidXchange with Corpay, which is a much larger payments company. Maybe you can do some things that you couldn't if you're on your own.
All right, well, let's move on to the sale of an Uptown office building for far less than its most recently assessed value. Which one, and what are the plans there?
Yes, this is an office building at 525 North Tryon, which is called 525 North Tryon. It sold last week for $24 million to Highland Ventures of Tennessee, according to the Charlotte Business Journal. Now, that is about a quarter of the building's assessed value. It was valued in the most recent property tax revaluation at $97.2 million. So we're seeing this trend uptown of these older office buildings selling for a quarter or a third, in some cases, of their assessed value, which is very unusual. But we've seen that play out several times in several other office buildings uptown. This is happening around the country as companies try to adjust to the realities of remote work. And you have a stock of older office buildings, you know, when a lot of companies that want to move somewhere want to move into newer office buildings.
So I guess now is a good time to buy if you're in the market for an office tower?
Yes, if you can rub some nickels together. Part of the thinking is also that now by buying these at a low price, maybe the buyer sees a way to renovate them, get some more tenants in, do some things that maybe the previous buyer didn't really have the option to because they were carrying so much debt.
Let's end on beer this week. I know breweries like to cash in on holidays like Memorial Day, but what about Mech Deck Day, which is nearly upon us, Tony? And lest listeners think we're making this up, can you just briefly explain what Mech Deck is?
Yes, Mech Deck Day in Mecklenburg County is May 20th. Every year, this year, it is the 250th anniversary of the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence, which is a signing of a Declaration of Independence a year before the National Declaration of Independence that we all know from Philadelphia. Some people believe it happened. Some people believe it didn't. But what's happening now is that we have a bunch of breweries in Charlotte that are creating Mech Deck-themed beers. Lost Worlds has put together a Mech Deck honey ale. Town Brewing, First in Freedom Lager, and Old Mecklenburg has a Giddy Up Pilsner. So there are ways to celebrate with this big anniversary coming up on the horizon, Marshall.
Well, whether it happened or it didn't, I don't need an excuse to have a pint. So thank you, Tony.
Thank you, Marshall. Let's raise a glass.
That's Tony Messia of the Charlotte Ledger Business Newsletter. Support for Bizworthy comes from the law office of Robertson & Associates. Advocates are concerned that several bills moving ahead in the North Carolina General Assembly will criminalize homelessness and make their jobs even harder. As WHQR's Kelly Knoyer reports, the legislation is backed by a Texas-based think tank.
The Cicero Institute was founded by venture capitalist and tech billionaire Joe Lonsdale and focuses on issues like regulatory reform and adding performance-based funding into the prison and parole systems. But the Texas-based institute is perhaps best known for its policies on homelessness. Cicero has become a bit of a boogeyman to housing and homelessness advocates because it's placed model legislation in the hands of state lawmakers, legislation those advocates feel will make things worse, not better, for the unhoused. Here's Latoya Agard, the executive director of the North Carolina Coalition to End Homelessness, speaking against one such bill in a House Judiciary Committee meeting in April.
I'm also glad today that the Cicero Institute has finally revealed itself as the sponsor and lobbyist for this bill. The Cicero Institute has been founded by a billionaire who is outside of our state. They have provided the template for this bill in other states around the country as an opposition to Housing First, which is documented and clearly has evidence that it does work when it is funded properly.
She was speaking out against House Bill 781, which bans the homeless from camping in public areas. Local governments could allow short-term exceptions in designated areas, but the bill doesn't provide funding for that. Devin Kurtz, the director of public safety policy for Cicero Institute, says the bill isn't intended to criminalize homelessness.
The goal here is not. And in fact, the mechanism is not conducive to trying to arrest homeless people. To the contrary, it is trying to create a subtle accountability for individuals who are refusing to accept help but really do need it, and making sure that we have some sort of recourse as a community when encampments are getting out of control.
Asked about areas where there aren't sufficient shelter beds available, Kurtz said that's not actually a serious problem, and that there are many gospel missions that have, quote, unrecorded shelter beds. Moreover, the goal is to pressure the local government to create sanctioned camping zones. Good Shepherd Center Executive Director Katrina Knight runs a shelter in Wilmington, North Carolina, and says that's untrue. Even if officials don't always know where all the beds are, local advocates do, and they're at capacity.
Most communities, with the increase in housing crisis brought on by, you know, runaway rent increases, you know, we don't have enough shelter currently.
Cicero Institute has also advocated for a drug-free zone near homeless shelters, similar to the enhanced penalties around schools. Kurtz says the aim there is to help the homeless.
I think that what we've seen as, you know, the leading cause of death among homeless people in my home state, Utah, is overdose. So what we've seen is that there is a vulnerable population that is dying of a thing that the system is not designed to try to intervene on or protect them from.
But Knight, whose shelter doesn't ban people for drug use, says that can cause more harm than good because it just means people will not seek shelter at all if they're in active addiction.
Past policy did fail, and that was the punitive approach. You know, there's, again, research after research that punitive measures tend to fall flat. They appeal to that need we have to see something being done. You know, I don't want as many people visibly homeless in this part or that part of town. Do something. Well, we do something and we pass punitive measures, but when they don't get to the heart of how to engage people and help them to a better situation, ultimately the numbers do increase.
She says low-barrier shelters like hers reach the hardest people to serve and get them connected with social workers and permanent housing that will eventually get them into a better place with issues like substance abuse and mental illness.
You engage that person and help them begin to take baby steps toward, you know, a better situation.
The drug-free zone policy passed the House and is now in the Senate. The camping ban is still making its way through the House committees as of this week, and it remains to be seen whether it will survive crossover day. I'm Kelly Knoyer.
And for Thursday, May 8th, that's Newsworthy. I'm Eric Thiel.